Disclaimer: the views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. We'll have a gay old time. From Orange County, California, I'm Zach Birchie. Welcome to AnCast. Justin is on vacation this week. He's actually at the wedding of Robin Savickas, his sister and the author of Anime News Nina. So happy wedding, Robin. Congratulations.
Woohoo!
And joining me is our resident pinch hitter, associate editor, Gia Manry. Hey, Gia.
Hey.
Thanks for finding time to come on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Of course.
How's it been going? You've been very busy with the interest feed.
Yeah, it's been really fun. It can be harder to dig and find all that stuff that people haven't already found sometimes. But it's been a lot of fun, especially seeing people say, "Why is this news?"
I like how Kotaku just solved that problem by adding the hashtag "How is this news?" Maybe we should just change it to the "How is this news?" feed.
It would be too long to fit in those tiny little icons.
We'll abbreviate it.
People ask me about this all the time, you know, because they read Anna and just the news feed, so they don't necessarily know what is what. So I tell them to, like, go to the page, and you see all the pink blocks? Those are mine.
Yeah, that's you.
The girl blocks are mine.
Ooh, I never thought about it that way. Sorry. Please don't sue us. for being sexist.
Egan posts interest sometimes too, and I do news sometimes too. So,
well, Egan is a man of mystery, so really,
he is that.
So, it's, you know, not a lot of news this week, and we have sort of an epic length conversation with Deb and Ed after this, which is super fun, but it's also really long, so we don't want to drag this on too long. The thing I got around to watching this week were the Full Metal Panic Blu-rays that Funimation put out. This has been out on Blu-ray in Japan for a couple of years. And it looks better than a DVD, but not like a full 1080p crazy ass. I mean, it's hard to remember that show, it's 4:3, it's not 16:9. It's kind of an old show. It's like from like 2001, I think. 2002. Mm-hmm. Did you ever watch that show?
No, I was always sort of scared of Full Metal Panic for no particularly good reason.
Really? I think I don't know. I never had a strong reaction to it when it first came out. Then when it finally came out on, like, DVD, I didn't have a strong reaction to it. I think it's because the characters are sort of one note, and they don't really change that much. So I watched, like, the first five or six, and was like, well, this is a show that exists. Like, if you're a fan, the Blu-ray's probably good buy, because it does look better than DVD, by a pretty substantial margin, but not... I don't know. I don't know. Like, I don't know any super hardcore fans of that, but I know it's popular.
Yeah, you know, I always felt like I should watch it, but it always, frankly, I mean, I say I was scared of it, but frankly, it always just looked really blah. Like, oh boy, another bunch of high school teenagers with some robots. Like, woohoo. I could never get myself, you know, nobody ever sat me down and said, here, you need to watch this. I never had some kind of happy, handy situation to watch it, so I just never did.
Yeah.
In fact, for the longest time, I avoided Full Metal Alchemist, thinking it was related somehow. This is obviously many years ago now.
Yeah, I was about to say, that must have been about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah. And I was just, so I never got around to Full Metal Alchemist until a friend of mine said, here, you need to sit down and watch this, so.
Yeah, I don't know, Full Metal Panic. I think it seems like one of those things that is, people insist it is popular. I do not really know who the fans are, but if it sells, great. Awesome. I got through the first, like, five or six, like I said, and I was like, oh, all right. So, yeah, not much of a reaction. And then Monday night was Halo night, and now I haven't been doing anything except that. In my spare time is all Halo all the time now, which will last for another 2 weeks, and then I'll get sick of it again. You know. So what have you been up to? What have you seen lately?
I've been keeping up on Occult Academy and High School of the Dead, been gearing up for the finales. Occult Academy, without getting, you know, too deeply into anything spoilery, it's kind of taken sort of this magical girl turn, which was kind of fun. It definitely is going kind of more for the wacky at this point, and
really?
Episode 11 also has some remarkably gross moments, which was sort of surprising.
Interesting.
And High School of the Dead is weird. Like, I think it's supposed to end next episode as well, episode 12, but it doesn't feel like it's gearing up for anything. So I'm not quite sure what's going to happen there, but it'll be zombie-rific.
High School of the Dead eventually turns into this weird kind of Randian survival fantasy, doesn't it?
You know, I don't know. Where they are right now is, like, you know, everybody's still kind of just trying to find a way to settle down and get the threat controlled enough, you know, that they can move on with their lives, sort of. They're currently hanging out at, like, this palatial estate where one of the characters' parents have sort of set up a crew, and they're sort of dealing with the fact that they've been, as kids, you know, dealing with everything themselves and taking care of themselves, and now all of a sudden they're back with adults, and the adults want to, you know, shove them back into kid roles, and so they're kind of trying to figure out what they're going to do about that.
That could be interesting.
Yeah, actually, I mean, you know, there are, for all the enormous sort of torpedo-shaped breasts that appear so frequently, and one rather infamous moment now, I think, with a swordswoman, there are actually some potentially interesting directions that they've gone. It's definitely a lot better than I kind of thought it would be from the first episode, which was just really boring to me.
The first episode is, yeah, every zombie cliche you've ever seen in one episode.
Exactly. But, you know, I mean, I will also say I'm watching it mostly out of habit. I don't think this is going to be, you know, like one of the greatest shows of the decade or anything remotely close to that. But it's been enjoyable.
I wonder if they're going to go into another season.
That's what I'm wondering. I mean, I know the manga goes on considerably longer than the anime has. And again, it doesn't feel like they've geared up. So I almost wondered if maybe I was wrong about it being 12 episodes, but that's how many are currently listed on the Anime Network site where they're streaming it. So I'm not really sure.
Interesting. I know there's a lot more. There's more manga material than they've covered. I know for sure.
Well, I didn't keep a second season of Skip Beat, so maybe it won't for... But I think zombies and high school girls with enormous breasts sell better than shoujo series about wannabe actresses. So.
Yeah, I'm sure it all depends on how the Blu-rays sell in Japan, and you know, they'll make more based on that. Actually, speaking of zombies, I should mention, of course, I ran to the theater to see Resident Evil Afterlife last Friday, because I'm a doofus who watches Resident Evil movies. It's weird with that series. I don't know what it is. There's, like, there's certain people, and I know other people like me, who, like, go see these in sort of shame, but I can't resist. Like, I have to go. If there's a new Resident Evil, I have to go see it. I don't know why. They're not good. But I mention it chiefly because the opening action sequence, the climax of it, is a direct lift of the shot in Akira of Tokyo exploding.
Really?
Yeah, it starts in Shibuya, actually, in the film. And it's the big glowing blue ball that slowly expands and is surrounded by smoke. I mean, it's the exact shot. Just done in, you know, crazy expensive CG 3D. So it's a I mean, I've never seen it actually done in live action before, like that directly. So it was kind of interesting. I will say, if you're the type of person who goes to Resident Evil movies, this is easily the best one. Like, I was very entertained the whole time. It's stupid as hell, but I was entertained the whole time. Because that's what I walked into the theater for, was stupid but entertaining. So,
fair enough.
So, yeah. Okay, anything else?
No, I have not gone out practically of this house because I'm getting ready for this move. So
yeah, you got your big move coming up. That's going to be nuts. All the way to Texas. Okay. All right. And a brief announcement. Sorry to say, I have to cancel the live Annecast at New York Anime Festival. Something came up. I can't. It's nothing big. It's nothing bad. It's not a problem. It's just... something happened. I can no longer go to New York, so that's not happening. But the ANN panel will still be happening. You'll be there. Chris will be there. Justin will probably be there, along with a plethora of our freelancers, including like Todd, Aaron Finnegan will be there, David Cabrera will be there. So if you want to meet all your favorite Anime News Network personalities, you know, New York Anime Festival is the place to do it. So anyway, let's go ahead and get to the guest.
All right.
Hold it, hold it!
Yeah, what's your matter?
What are you pitching Winston's at me for? You know I never smoke nothing else.
Just practicing, Mr. Flintstone. Everybody knows that.
Winston tastes good, like a cigarette should.
Yeah.
See you soon, Rocky.
Okay, we're back this week. We're chatting with newcomer... from MangaWorthReading.com, Ed Sizemore, I would say beloved personality among the the manga blogosphere, and returning champion, Debe Oki, from the manga editor from Manga.About.com. So thanks for showing up, guys, and chatting with us.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks. It's almost as exciting as an episode of Heat Guy J.
Hey, come on. I retired those references.
Now I didn't agree to that.
Now I have to edit that out. So the reason I'm sort of having y'all on is mostly to chat about... There's sort of a gulf between manga and anime fans, especially the people who write about this stuff, either as a hobby or for a living. You know, the increasingly rare someone who does this for a living. And you two are, you know, very prominent and well-liked among, you know, people who write about manga. And I want to know, you know, for starters, have you noticed this difference, and what about it to you is the most significant thing? And I guess I'll start with Ed on this.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like it's a smaller community, the manga review community. Although, if I actually look at manga blog, that's not as true as it once was. That list is getting pretty extensive. But certainly when I started back at the beginning of 2008, it felt like it was a pretty small enclave of people. And I think part of it is that, and I'm not going to name names or out anybody, but most of the people who are writing the reviews that I'm reading are over 30. You know, I myself am 43. And so I think that also takes into effect the differences, because we're a lot more mature coming at it from a little bit of an older perspective. And also a lot of the people are voracious readers, period. And manga tends to be one of the many genres that they enjoy.
So you think overall maybe it's a little bit more cerebral?
I think so. I mean, you know, my impression when I'm talking to people like Kate or Lisa or Deb or Melinda is that when they're reviewing, they really are trying to write something significant, trying to say something deep or meaningful about the books. It's more than just doing a plot summary and then I like it or I don't like it. It's trying to explore the themes and the characters, talk about what they found moving in the book or why the book didn't touch them. So, yeah, I mean, I think the people are trying to be a little bit more cerebral. And I don't know if you've been following Twitter, Alex Levitt is proposing kind of taking it up one more notch, where he wants to start writing reviews that are in discussion with other reviews. So like if he was reviewing, let's say, Pipachu, he wouldn't start with his own perspective. He would read the book, then he'd go out there and read all the reviews on, let's say, Pipachu Volume 2, and then he would write a review that kind of took all that into consideration.
Well, so, I kind of disagree with that. I mean, I actually go out of my way to not read anyone else's reviews before I write my own. Before I put out my own, just because I think you really can have your perspective infected by another writer. It's much like reading when I don't like reading movie reviews before I actually see the movie, because then I just glom on to what that movie reviewer saw and was annoyed by, rather than having a really fresh look at what I liked and didn't like about it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, otherwise it becomes this echo chamber where we're all just saying the same thing. One example of that is like when I wrote that my review of Seho Boys High School, you know, I wrote my review based on reading volumes 1 and 2, and I really loved it. And then I went out and read everyone else's reviews, and they all hated it because they all read volume 1. And I thought, you know, would I have written the same review if I had read everyone else's review first? Probably not.
Well, that's the kind of the discussion and that I'm having with Alex. And I understand that. I mean, I think all of us want to bring kind of a unique and fresh perspective when we do a review. We're very conscientious about not being influenced unduly. I mean, you're going to get influenced because, you know, people will put on Twitter that they've done a review, and usually hint is whether it's a good or bad review. So if you're somebody like me who's not, you know, reviewing books the minute they come out, I'm usually a couple weeks to a couple months behind. I get a general perception of, you know, whether or not the book is favorable or unfavorable in the review community. I won't go and read the review, so I won't know specifically what people like or dislike. Mm. But I'm the same with you, Deb. When I come to the book, I want to form all my own opinions, and I want to kind of get that on paper and then I want to go read other people's reviews. And I think that's – I don't think Alex understands that's how important it is for a reviewer to feel that what they're offering is honest and original and unique to who they are.
Well, it sounds to me like Alex is sort of trying to start a conversation between critics in a I don't know, publishable capacity, which is kind of weird. And honestly, every time I've seen someone write a review that takes someone else's review into context, it always comes across as kind of bitchy and complainy. Like they're disagreeing with this guy's review. And here's that actually happened to one of my writers, and I got pretty pissed off. One of Japan Editor's writers, Karen, decided to take Carlos Santos' review of something that had a bunch of fan service in it and use it to basically say, "I'm much more sophisticated about this than Carlo is." And I thought that was shitty and unnecessary. It's like, write your own review. You don't need to say what you need to say about it. You don't have to try to devalue or negate someone else's opinion while also offering your own. I mean, someone can write a bad review or a review that has, you know, opinions that aren't backed up by anything in it. Those are bad reviews. But just disagreeing and then turning it into an article about how much you disagree with this review or even agree with it. I mean, it's an interesting experiment. Maybe he'll give it a shot. But I don't know how that would go.
becomes part of this echo chamber effect, you know, where just this blogger is talking to other bloggers and we're really not doing what we're supposed to be doing, which is talking to readers. Yeah. And say, hey, you know, this is what I read. This is what I thought about it. You know, maybe it's worth your $10. Maybe it's not. You know, when we just react to each other, all we're doing is navel gazing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's actually one other thing that I've noticed. That's the difference between the anime community and the manga community. You guys are much more insular and you do talk to each other a lot more. When you say like, well, we need to talk to the readers. When I go to your comment section, it's people like Ed commenting on it.
Yeah, and frankly, I think it's great that we have these kind of discussions because we're obviously very passionate about manga. But, you know, I mean, when I go out to the cons and I take photos of people, you know, in their costumes, I say, what manga do you like to read and why? And a lot of times they'll say, I don't read manga. I watch anime. Mm-hmm. And I said, but you're dressed as a character the anime was based on a manga. Says, well, I don't read manga. So that's where I feel like I fail. Honestly.
How is that a failure for you?
Well, I feel like, you know, that there's people out there that could be reached who could be interested in this stuff, but aren't reading it. And that's when I kind of like, you know, that's when I kind of try to check myself. Like, you know what, Deb, you ain't all that. And what you said ain't reaching everybody. And you got work to do.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think there's more proselytizing among manga bloggers? Is it more of an effort to get the word out and get people to read this stuff?
that's a tough one. I don't know. Ed, you want to tackle that one first?
Well, I mean, certainly we want people reading our reviews and going to buy the books. And it is tough. I mean, yeah, I can't force people to come to my blog. I mean, you can be on Twitter and... I'm fortunate that Manga Worth Reading is part of a larger site, Comics Worth Reading. So there are at least people who are not native manga readers who at least see that I'm writing reviews, and occasionally they do check it out and purchase some things. Mm-hmm. But I think part of the frustration is, you know, we live in a society that reading isn't as valued as it once was either. So you're kind of fighting that cultural force, you know, which is part of the whole print is dead kind of movement. Mm-hmm. So, I understand your frustration, Deb, but I also think if you go to an anime convention and, let's say, 60% of the people there don't read manga, you might want to ask that same 60%, do you read at all? And I think you're going to find that most of them probably don't, on an, you know, apart from like school readings. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's always a problem, you know, kind of in the age of video and internet, is getting people back to reading books. So, yeah, I think we have that kind of that dual problem.
Mm-hmm. Gia's here. We should we should bring her in a little bit. So, Gia, I gotta ask. I mean, what have you noticed in terms of like the differences between the manga community and the anime community, specifically the people who talk about this stuff?
Well, I think one of the things I was trying to find just the right moment to insert was that, you know, you can't watch manga on mainstream TV. So how you get into manga is very different than how you would get into anime. People who get into manga are usually people who are huge, huge book readers, particularly people interested in comics, or who are people who got particularly involved with the anime fandom online and sort of came into manga that direction. So I think you get people who are a lot more invested. You don't get the kids who just watch Bleach on TV, which shifts the demographics a lot, clearly. Ed mentioned the age thing, and it definitely seems to me that there are a lot more manga bloggers who are adults. And by that, I don't just mean people over the age of 18, but I mean people who come to it from an adult mindset and an academic mindset, which is it's real interesting for me to sit back and sort of compare and contrast, since I have dipped my toes in both worlds so much.
Right. And actually, that's a really good point, because just now that all the scanlation sites are kind of coming down, at least the big ones seem to have been pulled down effectively. There's much more commitment involved in having to read a manga. Like, you have to go to even if you're just going to go to the store and graze, mm-hmm. You know, lay down in the hallway or whatever and read everything. That's still more of a commitment than just turning on your computer and downloading something. I mean, it does take more. It takes effort, and it's kind of funny that just a little bit of effort automatically excludes a huge crowd of teenagers.
I mean, I think you're basically looking at the same dichotomy of, like, people who review books are very different than people who review films, for example.
Yeah, I think there's less of a difference there than there. Yeah. I mean, people who actually have jobs as film critics, the five people who still have jobs as film critics, I pay very close attention to that world. And the difference between a serious film critic like an A.O. Scott or a Tasha Robinson and somebody who's reviewing a book. I mean, you can even just browse the AV Club, the Onion's AV Club, which right now is like the best clearinghouse for media criticism out there. They're both high-minded folks who take this stuff seriously and sincerely love it. With this, it seems like a lot of the anime blogging I see, it's LOL, I downloaded this, here's some screen caps, here's some hot fan service, I give this episode 10 out of 8 or whatever, you know.
The episode-by-episode blogging always mystified me. The only time it was ever useful was when I had to write up episode descriptions and I couldn't remember which episode this thing happened in. But other than that, I've never understood the value particularly of that style of blogging.
Now here's something I don't know. Is there chapter by chapter manga blogging?
There's volume by volume.
Okay.
But there's, it's interesting. I've always kind of wondered about the value of that, because I find it more interesting to review a whole story arc than a single volume.
So you don't do single volumes?
I do, actually, but I do it as, like, volume one.
Mm-hmm.
If I can't, like, for example, like Kikaishi, for example, is, like, maybe 20-something volumes right now, and I've been wanting to tackle reviewing it, but I think I can only really review it as, you know, the arc, this story arc, this story arc, this story arc. But the value of reviewing volume ones is, like, this is new and in the stores, you know, you might want to check it out. And, you know, my take on reviewing it is a little more guarded than it is when I can review an entire arc. Because there's a lot, one thing with manga is that a lot of times the first volume sometimes is not the best volume.
Barely representative of the series as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, that's when, like, for example, if you read the first volume of Bleach, it is so different than what you read in volume 20. You know, I mean, volume one, he's just this goofy high school kid who can see ghosts. And whoops, he runs into this chick who can also see ghosts. Who just happens to be a ghost. And look, his dad is so funny and his sisters are so goofy. It is not the same after volume 10.
Yeah.
I liked Bleach at the beginning.
I mean, it's some funny moments, but, you know, the groove gets different.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really difficult, because one of the dynamics of being a manga reviewer is that a lot of times a lot of the publishers will only send you volume one. And so if you want to review everything else, you got to invest and you got to buy it. That's $10 a shot.
Minimum.
And, Well, and interestingly, this is a discussion on the American comics side of the house because, you know, American comics now generally are written in 4 to 6 issue arcs. Mm-hmm. And so there gets a lot of discussion about, do you review issue 453 or do you wait until the entire 6-issue arc is complete before you review it? And I've, you know, my perspective, I guess, is you're buying it 1 issue at a time. You're consuming it 1 issue at a time. So I write the review, and like you do, Deb, I mean, I may hate volume 1, and the publisher may send me volumes 2 and 3, and I may end up having to kind of eat my own words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the truth of the matter is, you know, if somebody hadn't given me, or you know, volumes 2 and 3, I wouldn't have bought it. So my opinion on volume 1 was an honest take on the book at that moment. Mm-hmm. And it just happened to be that for whatever reason, I gave it a second shot. I mean, and sometimes, you know, a second shot is reading another review and, you know, somebody saying, you know, I think there's potential here, or somebody saying, I know for a fact that volume 2 gets better, you know, because I've looked at the Japanese edition. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sit it out. And so, I do understand that. And it is a conundrum. And you're right. I mean, it's funny. I always tell people on a long series, let's say like a Bleach or a Naruto, you may have to get 3 or 4 volumes in before it kind of settles into whatever rhythm the series is going to have.
Mm-hmm.
Which for most people, that's kind of an odd notion that you have to read 600 pages before the series settles down. And you say, well, I mean, they're cranking this out, and sometimes, you know, they've pitched the idea 1 week and they're having to draw it the next week and they really haven't worked out all the bugs. And so they don't get that luxury of saying, okay, well, in 6 months when I, you know, publish my first chapter, you know, sometimes the editor says, okay, well, you know, we go to press on next Wednesday. You've got 7 days. Give me 20 pages.
Right. Yeah. That's interesting.
I can totally relate though to the idea that being told to read more of something that you didn't dig the beginning of is really frustrating. I could give you a mile-long list of all the anime series and manga series that I've dabbled, you know, a couple episodes or a volume or two in and just couldn't get into. And people are like, oh, no, you've just got to read the next chapter. You've just got to watch the next episode, and it'll be totally awesome from then on. Fate Stay Night. Everybody wants me to watch more Fate Stay Night. And I watched 6 episodes of it, and I was bored to tears, and I was, forget it, I'm not going to do it.
Gia, if you just invest 6 hours of your precious life into this, I swear it gets better.
It will change everything.
But I also, like, you know, like, I think the manga community, I think there's a certain tone that gets set by the people who are here already in the room, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I think, like, for example, Kate and David and Bridget are all very, you know, very sharp, very intellectual reviewers. Kate Dacey is the mangacritic.com. David Welsh is manga curmudgeon. Bridget Alverson is mangablog.net, I think it is. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you've got these people in the room, and they've kind of set a tone for reviews that are, I guess, very, very thoughtful, very, they take into account other things other than manga. They take into account literature themes, sociological themes. They come from a very diverse and very interesting perspective when they read the book. So a lot of times when I'll read their reviews, they have a completely different take than I maybe would have had. Like, oh, I never noticed that, or oh, that's really interesting. So you've got these people in the room, and they've kind of set the tone. Whereas I think sometimes in anime blogging, the people in the room set a different tone. Like, you've got your Sankaku complex who sets a different tone, you know? You've got your Japanator who sets a different tone. The people in the room set a tone for what is out there, I think, in the criticism community.
I think it's, and part of the reason that I even wanted to talk about this is because manga blogging, I haven't seen every single manga blog out there who could, but that tone is much more consistent and much more unified. It's hard to find a manga blog that doesn't have that sort of high-minded kind of intellectual tone to it. Whereas it's incredibly easy to find, very juvenile. Yeah. And you find all the whole spectrum is there. And I'm sure the whole spectrum is there in manga, but the feeling is the people who actually get read, the people who have readers, they all have that tone. Whereas with anime, you will get a wildly different take on Sankaku than you will get on ANN. And those are, we're like opposites almost. And so you know.
And that made for a really lively conversation, which is fun. I almost kind of wish there was more of a spoiler in the manga community that just, you know, that loves the trashiest shit and can like defend it to their death.
Erica's trying. Erica Friedman is trying very hard on that front.
Scott does a great job of that. In fact, I really love, I like Scott's reviews sometimes because he's like the champion of moe.
Oh, yeah.
He's the only guy who will stand up and say, you know what? I love moe and I'm proud. And here's why.
There's guys like that. He's not.
No, and I think that, you know, because it's like, you know what? I respect that you, that's where you're coming from. And God damn it, I knew somebody out there was buying this shit.
Well, and now we also have to mention that a lot of the manga bloggers have master's degrees or better, too. You know, Kate, Robin, myself, Johanna, and a couple others all have master's degrees in something. And that that might be part of the contributing factor, too, is that you're talking about a fairly literate and well-educated group of writers.
Well, and
who have, just like to write.
And who have been trained to analyze things in a certain way. That's a very specific way of analyzing things.
Right.
You know, you certainly don't see quite as much of that. But here's a question for you guys. Among manga bloggers, the people who don't... I don't know how many of you guys actually do this full-time for your job. I know neither of you guys do. But among the people who do, or even among the serious hobbyists, the people who have people who actually have readers, I guess that's a good way to quantify this. What's the typical profession that they act? What's their real job? Do you guys have any idea?
We have a lot of librarians, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've always thought there were quite a few librarians or other people involved in libraries and schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I said, like Kate, Robin. Are both librarians.
Kate's actually, is she a librarian by trade? I thought she was in music. She's a scholar.
It's a music library. Maybe I just assumed it was a book library.
No, I mean, I guess that's a big part of what she does. I mean, because she writes for Good Comics for Kids, and so she's very thorough, and so she goes to these conferences. I mean, I go to conferences, too, and that's not my day job, because you want to keep up with what's going on.
Right. Well, see, that's a very interesting contrast, because in anime, it's like 90% bored IT guys. Like, seriously, it is. My boss is an ex-IT guy. You know, I'm one of the, it's like me and like a handful of other people that I know that actually get paid to write about this stuff, that do not come from an IT background. It's a lot of engineers. I mean, I Carlo is an engineer. Theron is a math teacher. You know, it's very like from the technical side of things. I could not even begin to explain why that's a phenomenon. I guess nerds like anime, but
like Lissa, I think, comes from an art background. I come from an art background. Bridget and I have journalism in our past lives. Mm-hmm. So
right, that's a real clear delineation. I didn't know it was quite that stark.
Right.
That's very interesting.
I was at a panel once, and somebody said something about my having a journalism degree, and people applauded, and I was a little weirded out by it.
That's because you are rare. I mean, you're an anime journalist who actually has a journalism degree, and I actually believe that makes you one of a kind at this point.
I know a few others.
I don't think so, but I mean, when you have a journalism background, you have different standards for what you consider news and what you're willing to go out there with.
Well, the chief difference is that you know how to do things like check sources and verify quotes.
That's kind of what I meant.
don't seem to know what to do, but that's not our topic today.
That's right.
So now here's a question, and this may sound a little, I don't know, insulting, but one thing I have noticed as a result of this very high-minded academic tone, sometimes it feels like they're forgetting that they're writing about comics for Japanese children. I've read reviews where they were, and don't get me wrong, it was still a fine review, but it was sort of blisteringly pretentious. And they were writing about, like, Naruto Volume 15 or something like that. Mm. And I'm just sitting there, like, what? You are, this is a way too high-minded a tone for this material. Right. Do you guys ever struggle with that? Have you noticed that?
I definitely agree with that. I mean, because sometimes I'll stop myself, like, when I, like, if I read a really fluffy shoujo manga, sometimes I kind of have to stop myself. And you know what? You're not a 13-year-old girl anymore.
Yeah.
And just kind of think back, when you were 13 and if you read something like this, would you love it? Would you hate it? You know, keep in mind that it wasn't made for you. And that's why so much of us are like, oh, seinen manga is so awesome. You know, everyone should read Pluto and 20th Century Boys and, you know, Drunken Dream, because this stuff is so awesome. It's like, yeah, because it was created for people our age and our experience and our love of manga. But, you know, like, I'll read, like, Reborn and go, like, oh, my God, this is inane.
Mm-hmm.
I can't read this. And I swear I read 20 volumes of Reborn trying to go,
Jesus,
people love this shit. Why do they love this shit? Why? And then I finally had to throw it to the side and go, you know what? Because I'm not 15 anymore. I'm just gonna resign myself to that.
Yeah, actually, brief anecdote. When I was in Japan in April for Tokyo Anime Fair, we were in Jonathan's, which is a Denny's. Mm. And we were in Otome Road.
Mm.
You know that little area where all the the Fujoshi area of I think it's Ikebukuro.
Ikebukuro, yeah.
Yeah, long story short, there was a group of Japanese schoolgirls at a table. It's like four or five of them. And one of them comes running in with a pack of, I guess, trading cards. They were Reborn trading cards. Mm. And they just started ravenously opening these things up and just like comparing and shit. And man, that show. Anyway, very popular with 15-year-olds. That's interesting. It's really hard to contextualize. At the same time, you can't lower your standards and say, like, well, maybe a 13-year-old would like this, but that's because he's 13 and doesn't know that it's junk.
Yeah, I mean, I don't try not to write reviews that say, like, well, you know, if you had lower standards, maybe you like this. I think, you know, I mean, I feel my responsibility is to say, like, you know, here I am. I'm a reader. Here's my honest opinion of what I thought of it. The art was okay. The story was this. The characters were this. I don't know where the hell this is going. Maybe you have to be on drugs to really love this. But, you know, I mean, I feel like I've read reviews where all they've said, like, oh, you know, this is great if you're like a blank and a blank and a blank. And it's like, well, did you like it or not?
That's not a review. That's marketing.
Yeah.
That's not reviewing something.
So it's like, I like it when, like, I can't remember the name of the blogger, but she gets her daughter to review the kids' manga.
Hmm.
And I think that's awesome.
At the same time, you run into the thing where anime and manga specifically breaks most of the rules in terms of you are this age, so you're supposed to enjoy this.
Mm.
I love the crap out of plenty of shows that are aimed at Japanese kids.
Sure.
And they have plenty of elements and stuff that appeal to adults. You know, One Piece being sort of chief among them. That's definitely a kid's thing. But it, you know, it's got plenty in there for an adult who enjoys adventure stories to enjoy. And so you kind of run into a trap. Like, I don't want to read a 13-year-old's review of something that I'm potentially interested in. I want someone my age to tell me whether or not it's a waste of my time.
That's sort of what I was thinking about when you talked about the really pretentious review of Naruto or whatever. Is like, you know, if people come to your site wanting to know what a high-minded, you know, super academic, pretentious sort of guy thinks about Naruto so that they know whether they'll like it because that's the kind of person they are, then... You know, shouldn't you still maintain kind of what your opinion on it is from your perspective? The idea being that they're coming for a perspective similar to yours, or else the opposite, so they know not to read it or whatever. I mean,
I guess
there's some of that going on too.
I mean, it's trying to think, like, who is your reader? I mean, sometimes maybe we forget to keep that in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, I think like for when I'm writing, I'm like trying to write for a general audience. So sometimes I will explain terminology, or I will explain tropes, for example, that maybe people who are more deeply ingrained in the culture don't feel necessary to explain. But like, for example, I was reading the NPR review of Drunken Dream, and he readily confesses, I don't read a lot of shoujo manga, but, you know, so I count on other people to explain it. but here's my impression of the book, given that I'm a person who doesn't read a lot of shoujo manga. I've got this impression. I got that impression. It touched me this way and that way. And I thought that was valid.
Ed, yeah. What do you think?
No, I mean, I agree. I think maybe some of it is a little bit cultural. Like the example I can think of for myself is Astro Boy. And Astro Boy was written for 8 to 10 year olds. And, you know, I love the world out of Astro Boy. And I mean, I've read more than one Astro Boy story where I put the book down and just, you know, had to think about what was going on for half an hour. Because Tezuka is a master of writing for multiple audiences at once. So, sure, Astro Boy has got a lot of action, it's very quick paced, but then he's sneaking in these messages about pacifism, he's putting in these messages about moral responsibility, about even things like the ecology. So there's he does a lot of that because he's thinking, even if I'm writing for an 8-year-old, you know, this 8-year-old's going to grow up, and if I want the story to have some kind of resonance in his life, then it can't just appeal to who he is now, but it's got to appeal to who he will be in 20 years. And an excellent example of that is the fact that, you know, Urasawa wrote Pluto because of the Astro Boy story that he just couldn't let go of him in his own life. Mm-hmm. So I think some of that is the Japanese stories tend to be multi-layered. And, you know, like fiction for children, like the Muppet Babies. Let's take an example. If we're going to use like an American cartoon show, the Muppet Babies is written for, let's say, an 8-year-old audience. And it's only written for an 8-year-old audience. And they're not putting a lot of themes into it because they're so worried about being educational and they're so worried about being relevant to this 8-year-old that they're not thinking.
It's a bit of laziness, I think, don't you think? Yeah. I mean, when you're trying to go by formula, you see that in Pixar films are obviously geared towards kids, but adults love them to death because there's stuff there for them. There's a quality of writing. There's a quality of characterization. And I think regardless of what audience a story is for, if it has those certain elements of quality, you can enjoy it whatever age you are.
Yeah. I mean, when I'm watching Muppet Babies, I often think, I wish this were edgier. but that's very true, and it's actually particularly relevant to anime. Look at Sailor Moon. That is a kid's show through and through, like Monster of the Week kid's show, but it has millions of adult fans who love it to death. And you know, anime in particular is one of those things where it crosses that age boundary more so than a lot of other things, I think, and that's why a lot of people find it appealing. Sure. You know, I don't know if, you know, that ties into review philosophy or not, but it's definitely one of those things.
Well, I think, you know, like, given when you come to be a reviewer, it means that you've consumed an X amount of a certain product and you can kind of like go, okay, I've read a certain amount of this. I've experienced a certain amount to know what I like and what I don't like.
What do you think the biggest difference is in terms, like, You said, like, when you become a reviewer, it's because you've consumed X amount. Also, obviously, because you want to have a voice, you want to engage with this more than just being a consumer. Mm-hmm. You want to be a pundit, basically. Mm-hmm. Is there do you see a lot of... Because in anime, it seems like a lot of people blog about it just because they want another facet to their hobby. They don't just want to watch it. They also want to say something about it. Do you see a lot of that in manga blogging? Do you see people who it's kind of like it's an exercise, not really like they're really thinking about their review and they're concerned about their voice and what their readers want from them, you know, that kind of a thing?
I think those bloggers who don't take those things into account, that don't spend the time to think about who their readers are or what their voice is or what their opinions are and taste is on things, those bloggers tend to come and go. They tend to disappear within a year because they can't sustain it. You have to have a certain conviction of why you're doing it, because it is a lot of work. It is, and frankly, I'll be honest. There's a lot of manga that skirts that line of just pure boring mediocrity, where it's like, oh my god, if I had to review every single manga out there, I would shoot myself because a lot of it's pretty boring. But you wait for those shining moments, like, oh my god, this book is so freaking awesome, I gotta tell everybody. That's what you do it for.
Well, and Jason Thompson has preserved his sanity, thankfully.
Just barely.
But,
did you see him after he wrote that book? He was emaciated.
Yeah.
Well, and I think there's some truth into what you're saying, Deb, because when I'm thinking about the people whose reviews I tend to read and the people I tend to respect as reviewers, there is a real passion for the medium. And so they keep doing it because they keep reading manga and it just so moves them and they so connect to it that they feel compelled to discuss it. It's not necessarily an ego thing. I mean, it is an ego thing to some extent because all of us want to get some recognition out of it. But part of it is also just an overwhelming desire to say, this is such an amazing book. And all Pluto is probably the one example I use because it just recently ended. So amazing. Every time I put the book down, I wanted to talk about it, wanted to discuss it, wanted to work through its themes. Mm-hmm. That is one of those series where you're like, I am so glad I read manga, because if I hadn't read this, I encountered it later, I would be so upset. I'm glad I got to read it now and got to experience it. And it's true. I mean, I think we forget that there is a lot of crap out there. Mm-hmm. And the hard part is, when the manga boom, let's say 2007, 2008, when people were trying to bring everything over, it was that first time, I think, for the American audience to go, wow, there's
not
just as much.
And it's awesome.
There's just as much bad comics in Japan as there are bad comics in America.
It's true.
And like you said, like Reborn, you read Reborn and you're like, God, why are people reading this? And then, I can pull one of several Marvel comics off the shelf, look at it and go, oh my God, this is the best selling comic right now.
It's like why dog do whistles, people you know, this? It's like they can hear it on a different frequency than I can. And I just cannot see it. I can't hear it. I can't hear the siren call of what makes Reborn awesome. It's just on another plane. Sorry.
That's fun.
I'm sorry.
I mean, that's true. And, it's a funny thing because when you the parallel, I think, is with anime. When you had the CEO of Crunchyroll on and he was like, well, we want to bring everything over. We want to bring all the shows every season and make them instantly available. And I kept thinking, people, the whole glimmer of anime is going to wipe clean really quick. Because you have to wade through a lot of garbage, and
any form of entertainment, you have to wade through.
It is, but it was really funny because when I first got into, because I started out as an anime fan and then got into manga, and I was reading a guy who was living in Japan, and literally, once or twice a week, well, at least once a week or once every other week, somebody would email him and say, "So what are the hidden gems out there?" And he'd say, "You guys, look, I'm telling you. The stuff you're getting is the best of the best. There is no secret stash of stuff that the Japanese are keeping that they're not releasing to America. The stuff that they're not releasing needs to stay over here. Be thankful you're not getting it." And people just didn't believe him. But now with Crunchyroll, I think they're finally going to say, wow, when it was a gated community, it was a better place.
Yeah.
We can allow for people that have different taste. I mean, I allow for the fact that there are people who love manga that I will never really resonate with. It's okay. It's okay. There's all kinds of readers. There's all kinds of stuff. I mean, I'll be the first one to say that there's a lot of manga that is super popular that just flies over my head, and I'm okay with that.
Well, so doesn't the coming deluge of manga from Crunchyroll's crazy initiative to bring everything over? Doesn't that make your job that much more relevant, important, pertinent?
It is relevant and important if we're actually reaching readers. I honestly think that a lot of the readers who are picking up manga, they're listening to each other. They're in the forums. They're reading the "What are you reading now?" post by other fans. They're not really necessarily reading manga bloggers. I think what we're doing is we're mostly talking to each other. We're talking to librarians who buy books. We're talking to booksellers who sell books. We're talking to publishers, maybe.
Yeah.
But we are not doing what we really need to do, which is talking. Like, I personally feel like my mission is to talk to other people who like comics who don't necessarily read manga. Or talking to people who read, who don't read comics and don't read manga, who could be turned onto manga. I have a friend who's a sommelier, and I've given him the sake volume of Oishinbo or Kami no Shizuku, and he says, "Hey, this is pretty neat." You know, I mean, so I feel like my job as a reviewer, my job as a kind of like a manga evangelist, is to try to reach beyond as much as possible.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting take, and I think you're right when you say it's like mostly just people talking to each other, which you it's said fun like in you said way. It yeah it's fun. I mean, you said there's danger in that because it becomes this echo chamber,
mm-hmm.
but it also gets a little exclusive,
clicky.
Very much so. Like when I announced at the beginning of this year, hey, my big thing for this year is more manga coverage on ANN. And initially, I actually met with some people saying ANN can't really, you guys aren't sophisticated enough to cover
seriously
manga. Oh yeah, no, I got some shit. I thought and my initial thought was fuck you, watch me do it. And
because obviously, you know, the manga of Vampire Knight just has themes so far beyond your brain compared to the Vampire Knight anime. I'm just saying that yeah. Completely different beasts.
No, no. So, I mean, there's a little bit of, dare I say, snobbery going on a little bit in the world of manga reviewing. And that is antithetical to gaining readers. Let me just tell you that.
Well, that's really odd because when you announced that, I was actually really happy because, I mean, you guys get a ton of traffic. And so, you know, having more reviewers and being a little bit more prominent with the reviews, I was like, great, that's just more eyes on the page. But you've rightly chastised me on this. I mean, poor Carlos has, you know, been doing it for years, kind of as an unsung hero. And, people do tend to forget that Right Turn Only has been on the site and has been doing, you know, good, solid reviews. I have nothing against Carlo's reviews. I think he writes really well. And he just has not gotten the recognition that he should for the work he's done.
Carlo has lots and lots and lots of readers. But here's the thing, and actually let me ask you guys about this, in terms of getting comments. Now, the average controversial news story on ANN gets hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of comments. The average anime review gets 7,500 comments. Sure. The average manga review gets 15. And I'm sort of curious, how much discussion do you guys really generate with manga? Because I have definitely noticed people really don't talk about it that much. There's not a lot of conversation, you know?
I don't... Possibly because we don't necessarily throw out a super controversial opinion when we write a manga review. I think people generally think, oh, well, that was your take on it. Okay, whatever.
So this is another difference in terms of the community, in terms of the consumer.
I guess so. I mean, unless I've really went out of my way to, to say, oh my God, this thing sucks. Such balls. You don't want to know. Then, you know, maybe then people who said like for example, if I dared to, okay, I'm totally going to give shit from all the Reborn fans after this. But if I wrote a review of Reborn and said just how much I don't get this, then yes, I will get comments saying, you don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
Or just like if I wrote a review about Vampire Knight and said, you know what, this kind of doesn't make a lot of sense. I would get but you don't understand.
Hey, now I have thoroughly trashed Maria Hollick, Le Chevalier d'Eon, and now currently Quasar the Stigmata. And I still don't get comments.
I don't think people can disagree with you on that one, though.
I know, Chevalier, I remember because I really dug the Chevalier anime, so I picked up the manga. What is that? Oh, it's so...
How does anyone jump around with that much clothing on?
Actually, I had not seen the anime until somebody... I went to a convention and was one of those panels where here's some great stuff you haven't seen and you should be watching. And as soon as they showed the opening for the anime for Le Chavier, I looked at it and went, I have been so ripped off. I have read 3 volumes of that god-awful manga, and it is nothing like the anime. And I have been avoiding the anime for fear that it was just the animated manga. And they're like, oh, yeah, it's totally different writers, totally different characters. I was like, oh, I have been cheated.
But that happens vice versa as well. I mean, like, yeah. Like when I first picked up the Soul Eater manga, like people were like, I would, everyone said, oh, Soul Eater is so awesome, you know. But they were, that was based on the anime. And then when I tell people, like, but the manga's kind of, I don't get it. And then they're saying, oh, because that's because the anime is so much better. Oh, okay. My bad.
Wow. That's, yeah. Hmm.
And I'm sure there's vice versa where, like Ice Shield 21 anime, I think is horrible. I think it's so poorly done.
Oh, boo. I like the anime.
It's awesome. I think the manga's so awesome.
So actually, that brings me to sort of another thing I wanted to ask about. Ed, you mentioned like you don't really get a lot of comments on what you're writing,
right?
And I'm curious to know, a lot of blogs are sort of talking into a void. They don't have readers. They don't generate discussion. What would you guys say like the cutoff is in terms of like okay. Stop doing this. You're not putting forth a perspective that people are interested in reading, because there's so many of these things out there. And I wonder, like, if you're not providing a new service or a unique perspective, and Ed, I'm certainly not saying that about your blog. You clearly have, you know, a readership, just one maybe that doesn't necessarily turn into a discussion.
Right.
But what is the cutoff? When would you tell somebody, dude, find something else to do? Or does it even matter? Is it just like it's all fine because it's just a hobby?
Ooh, that's a good question. Because
I sort of wonder what the reward is. Like, why would somebody write if they didn't have an audience?
Right. I guess well, and there is more than one person who does that, unfortunately. Although, you're not getting a lot of free books, so.
That part of it, you know, yeah. I mean, there's a certain joy to it, but you know, it's a lot of work to do it. And at a certain point, that's why there's a certain amount of blog burnout, because you do want to feel like what you're saying is being responded to. It is very depressing that first, you know, couple months, maybe year that you're doing a blog and you get no replies, you get no comments. You start thinking, oh my God, you know, it's like, I'm like the tree that just fell in the forest and did it. Not even the bears heard me, you know? Why am I doing this? But, so that's partly why what I do is I don't just review. I go to the conventions. I try to talk with people. I try to do interviews with the artists, try to write news articles. I try to be a little more, more about manga in general. Just trying to share the world.
Well, it sounds to me like you are involved in the community. And that's what makes you relevant. That's what makes you a personality. That's what gives you readers. Because you're more, it's not just, I read this book and here's what I thought. Mm. You're part of the community. Do you think that that's now, and Ed, so are you. You're definitely part of the community. You're a known face. You guys show up at panels, conventions. Do you think that's a necessity to be relevant now?
I think it's relevant. I think it's, well, I don't know if it's a necessity to be relevant, but I think it really helps your perspective. It stops, like, because I think we go to the panels and we get to, you know, we understand the mechanics of the business. There's a lot less of, you know, like, why aren't publishers doing this? And why aren't publishers doing this? And why aren't they bringing Kochikame in? Why aren't they doing this? Why aren't they bringing my favorite series that's 100 volumes long that only a Japanese people would understand? We get it.
Kochikame, Jesus. Talk about the suicide license.
Learn Japanese. It's a lot faster, people. If you want to read Kochikame, learn to read Japanese.
Well, you know, I like going to the conventions to be part of the community. And you're right. I mean, it would be nice to reach a younger audience. I mean, I'm definitely feeling that nobody under 20 is probably reading my blog, unfortunately. But part of that is I don't write for a crowd that's under 20, and I'm not sure I know how to write for a crowd like that.
Well, you have your audience.
I guess an example would be my niece is getting into manga, so it's interesting to see what she's reading. Like, she's just discovering Fruits Basket, so she loves that, and she's a big Twilight fan, so I'm sure Vampire Knight is gonna be on her reading list fairly soon. Or talking to some of the kids at church who are just getting into manga. The problem is for them it's all new, mm-hmm. and so they're reading stuff like when they're reading like Fruits Basket or Chibi Vampire or something like that. For them it's all new and shiny, and they just want to encounter whatever they can get their hands on. Whereas for me it's like, well, Fruits Basket, yeah, that was great when it came out. The series is over. I'm trying to find something else to read, and I think that's part of it too, is that there's a certain level of enthusiasm for them that I have a hard time tapping into. I get enthusiastic, but again, it's about seinen stuff. So it's about Pluto, which most of the teenagers I know probably aren't going to be reading that, or 20th Century Boys, which definitely is not going to appeal to somebody who's 14.
Well, that's partly why I'm starting to think I've been starting to wonder whether I should tone back on the reviews and start doing more lists, like reading lists, mm-hmm. of recommended reading. Like, if you love this, like, you know how, remember record stores? Like, you could go into a record store and you say, I like this art, music by this particular artist. What else should I pick up? And the guy at the record store would say, you would like this for this reason, this, and this. Check it out. And there'd be a listening station. You could hear a track or two, and you could decide for yourself whether you wanted to pick it up and take it home. Right. So I, for example, the 50 essential manga for libraries list, I thought was a fun list to do. It was a lot of work, but I thought it was a good way to put out there, okay, here's the essential titles that every library should have, and here's why, and it would give you a good start. I mean, so even like, hey, you like Fruits Basket? Fruit Basket's only 23 volumes. Here's how you're going to get your next fix. Here's 10 essential shoujo manga that you'll love if you love Fruits Basket, for example. So, that would probably be more useful to people than single volumes of assorted series here and there.
But at the same time, like Ed, you were talking earlier, I started out doing just reviews. And I went to film school because I wanted to be a movie critic. Of course, that stopped being a job. But it's always been sort of in my blood. Like, when I see a movie, all I want to do is write about it and talk about it. That's it. And Ed, it sounds like you have that same kind of gene, where it's like you read something that really hits you, all you want to do is discuss and talk about it and write. And that's, to me, that's a sign of like a real critic, like someone who's really just genuinely interested in analyzing art. Is when all they want to do is sit down and dump words out about what they just saw. Like, it's a real sign. And I think, there's...
And it's a,
yeah, go ahead, sorry.
Well, and it's a curse, too, because there are a lot of books I can't read before I go to sleep. I mean, it's really weird. Pluto's a great example. I couldn't read Pluto before I went to sleep, because I would literally, after I'd finish a volume of Pluto... It would be on my mind. I could be doing anything. I could be watching a movie. I could be driving the car. Anything I was doing, I was thinking about Pluto. From the moment I put it down for the next 2 or 3 hours, that's all that was in my head. And I couldn't get it out of my head. And so, if I read it before I was supposed to go to sleep, I'd be up till, 2 o'clock in the morning thinking about it and working through it and going, that's great, that's great. And then I'd be thinking, when I write the review, I hope I remember half of this stuff, because I want to try to convey everything that's going through my head right now. And, it's making all these associations, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember, I read Ghost in the Shell did that. And then, oh, there was this sci-fi short story. Who wrote that? I got to figure out who wrote that short story that was really similar to this chapter in Pluto. And, it gets a little crazy sometimes. But you're right. I mean, it's part of the joy of it is... Mm-hmm. You have this huge cloud of thought, and then you funnel it into a review. And when you do it right, that moment of satisfaction is just so wonderful that you say, you know, I got all the important stuff down. Sure, there's a lot of details I would love to have talked about, but the important stuff is on the page and it's coherent. And I can hand it to somebody else and say, if you want to know why I read manga and if you want to know why I tout this series, read this. This will give it to you. It, you know, all of my passion is right here on the page.
Right, so, and that in turn attracts a readership because they see that passion. They see that you're serious about this. It's not just some weird narcissism or anything like that. It's not just my voice must be heard. It's
a passionate opinion. You know, I mean, if you're passionate about it, that's interesting to read. If you're just saying like blah 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 plot 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 plot, is okay.
Right.
That's why I force my critics to do their synopsis in the box, so they can't. They can't just turn in an 800-word plot synopsis that at the end says, if you like magical ninjas, you'll like this.
Well, and, you know, that's a good point. My first year as a reviewer, I really wasn't paying attention to synopsis. I mean, I would just write these really long plot reviews, and it was always like the first part of the review. So I'd always do that first, and then I'd get into the analysis. So mentally, I was kind of creating a block and saying, okay, this is the synopsis block. And now I go look at those first few reviews I wrote and I go, oh my God, when am I going to shut up about the plot?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it is interesting because you have to learn how to, you know, I try to keep it down now to the four sentences I consider to be a long synopsis to where I'm just getting to the heart of, like, you know, this, you know, Alice in Hearts. You know, like Alice in the Country of Hearts. This is Alice in Wonderland, and it's, you know, the Bishonen version of Alice in Wonderland. And then I might say, and, you know, she meets a couple new characters, and she learns a couple new things, and then I get into the analysis or I get into the review section. Particularly once you get into volumes like four or five of the series, you know, it's like, if you haven't read the first four volumes, I'm not going to be able to write in four sentences enough to get you up to speed and into this volume. I'm just going to have to trust that you've read the previous reviews or that you will go back and read them.
Yeah, actually, you know, that's one of the things that's really kind of made anime criticism a lot easier to do, is because we don't have the volume thing anymore. It's just a box set.
Right.
And so if Viz shipped you the complete series of Prince of Tennis or whatever, and you would have to do that as one review... God, that would be like,
and I have a lot of respect for Aaron and for Bamboo now, because I can tell you that trying to write about Paranoia Agent was really tough.
Yeah, because that's a tough show.
it didn't help that it was a show like every episode had its own message. And but really, you know, trying to condense 7.5 hours of video into, for me, it was 1,000 words, was really tough, and it made me appreciate what doing like a box set review was.
Right. And that doesn't, that opportunity just doesn't arise in manga, like, ever.
No, unfortunately not. The closest is going to be actually Exaholic, because the first 15 volumes, which are complete now, actually form a complete narrative, kind of like a season one.
Hmm. Interesting.
And I talked to William Flanagan, who is the translator for this, and he's, I think, if volume 16 hasn't come out, it's getting ready to come out in Japan. So he has already read the material because it's already been serialized. And so there is like this new season for Exaholic that's going to start, where it'll have new themes. I don't want to give any spoilers away, but new themes, some new characters will come in, and... So, I mean, that would be, like, the closest you could get. And a 15-volume review of manga is a lot. I mean, I had, you know, toyed with the idea of trying to do that, but I can't do it in 1,000 words, that's for sure.
Okay. So we're at about an hour. We should probably get to Twitter. There's not too many Twitter questions. But before we do that... what are you guys reading now that you would recommend? What should people be checking out?
20th Century Boys, anything by Urasawa. Exaholic, like I said, I'm trying to think what else. The one I'm actually getting ready to review volume two of, and Deb can correct me on my pronunciation, Moyashiman.
Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Moyashiman.
Yeah, Moyashiman, which is a really good manga. And Deb can talk about this a little bit more, too. And the mangaka apparently is getting no feedback from the American publisher, which is a real shame because he feels like the series is floundering here in the U.S., and he really wants it to develop an audience. And it's a wonderful book, so I definitely plug it. Trying to think what else that comes to mind that isn't like 30 volumes in at the moment. there's Yatsuba. I read for fun. I read like Yatsuba and Lucky Star. I've really developed a love for like Four Coma Comics, which is, I know, unusual, but they make really good bedtime reading. I mean, you read like 10 pages, and if you read them at that pace, they're really not that bad. So those would be the big ones, I think.
See. Deb?
This week I'm reading Drunken Dream again by Moto Hagio. That's really lovely collection. It's very deep, actually, for shoujo and jose manga. It's kind of dark and interesting. So I highly recommend that. Genkaku Picasso, there's a preview of that in the October issue, Shonen Jump, by Usamaru Furuya. Furuya, I think it is. That's really interesting. That's a very different shonen manga about a boy who draws, and he has to draw in order to stay alive, and he has to help other people. It's a kind of a dark and twisted shonen manga. It's the first one's not going to come out until November, but it's really worth checking out.
Now, Furuya is the one who did 51 Ways to Save Her, which was a CMX title that was going to come out until they closed down, right? That was Furuya as well?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes. Leechy Light Club, which is going to be coming out for Vertical next year. He does really interesting, delicate art, and he has a really twisted sense of humor, so I strongly recommend picking that up. If you're tired of the same old shonen manga stuff over and over again, this is very different, very interesting. I've been reading the last volume of Cat Paradise. That's a 5-volume series. I've been calling it like X-Men with cats. That's fun. Seiho Boys High School, which is, again, another really twisted shoujo manga, has a really funny sense of humor because it's all about boys, and they're boys who act like actual boys versus boys that shoujo manga readers wish boys acted like. So I think it's fun. I mean, the boys are horn dogs. They have foot and mouth disease. They're just strange and lovable. I found that to be really enjoyable. What else? Supply, of course. People Choose Evil, Cheese Sweet Home, and just the usual stuff I always pick up again and again. Like Otomen is just goofy. I wish I had a better stack of stuff. DMC, I enjoy reading. It just kind of pushes it to another level with each volume. Like, oh my god, after the Scat Rock one, the band who just sang about shitting all the time. Wow, they can't get any worse than that. But no, each volume just goes deeper and deeper down the toilet. Yeah. It's amazing. And I say that with love.
It really is. It's an offensive book that you find absolutely endearing. I like DMC too a lot. I mean, like, it's in the first or second volume where his big accomplishment is 11 rapes per second. He can say rape 11 times per second. Mm-hmm. And you think, on one level, your brain is going, my God, man, what are you reading? But the rest of me is going, shut up. This is really good.
I love those moments where there's manga that you think, there's no way in God's green earth would DC or Marvel put up something like this.
Exactly.
And that's just awesome.
All right. Okay, well, let's go ahead and get to Twitter. First up from Gundam Pilot Spaz, he wants to know, Ed, what makes you so dashing?
I don't know if I've ever actually been called that before, so I don't know if I can answer that question.
I think it's the cape. Just saying.
It's the cape.
Out of the cape.
I say it's the goggles. I'm going to go with the goggles. Okay, also from him, a serious question. Why didn't the Twilight manga sell as expected?
It did, didn't it?
No.
It was it was number one on that bestseller list for half the year.
Yeah.
How did you expect it to sell?
I think people expected it to come anywhere near one of the books, and it didn't even come close.
Yeah.
It fell very short. I think they were expecting more than what they got. It wasn't like a huge failure, but it really did not move as well as they were thinking.
I think some point, you know, there's a limit to how many times people want to repurchase the exact same story. This is something that happened to The Melancholy of Haruhi Suzumiya, which of course is huge in Japan, but they did, you know, like the novels came out first, then the anime came out, it became this huge thing, and they released a manga adaptation that was really bad, and nobody bought it, so they got rid of it, and they started a new one, and that one is still not selling very well compared to, like, the Chibi Haruhi series, which sells very well, and it's like, people don't want to buy a third copy of the same material, they want new material with those characters, whatever that may be. I think that's a big part of it, personally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Gia's onto a lot there. Part of it, I was thinking about that, was it probably didn't help that the movies came out because you already had a visualization that a lot of people loved. Yeah. So adding a second visualization probably didn't help. And part of it, I think, also is like, you know, I was a big Lord of the Rings fan, and I like the movies, but I never asked for comic books or movies. I was happy with the books as they were. For you know, decades as a fan, so there's a little bit of that too. I mean, I think sometimes, particularly when people get very emotionally attached and committed to something, they really don't want to see somebody else's vision for it. So,
I think if it had come out before the movie, it would have done a lot better just as a curiosity. Well, here's an interesting little stopgap while we're all waiting for the movie to come out. Because the minute that movie came out, now Robert Pattinson is Edward, and if you draw it any other way, it's not going to connect really with the fans. So I think that probably had a lot to do with it.
Another thing
it was so better if it was like side stories that you wouldn't have read in the books.
Yeah, new material would have been good too, I think.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Or material that got cut out of the books or got cut out of the movies, I mean.
You're dealing with the fact that In the manga and book reading and comic book, it was universally panned for having very poor layout.
Mm-hmm. And that weird font.
Yeah. So I don't know if that affected it. But, you know, honestly, they were trying to reach a different audience than just the core manga people. So I'm not sure if that's a valid criticism.
Well, yeah,
Whenever you adapt something into a different medium, I think you're trying to reach a different audience than the first medium reached. So you've got the books and you've got the movies to reach people who don't read books. And then you've got another set of what are books, albeit graphic novels as opposed to prose novels. So I think a lot of the people who were already into it had the books. And, you know, the movie people might not necessarily buy the comics, but you know what I mean? I sort of lost my train of thought there.
No, it makes sense. You're further fragmenting your fan base. You're splitting up the number of people. Like, certain Twilight fans will, all of them will go to the movies. All of them will buy the books. Beyond that, you've got an issue. So I think we now see how many of these people are actually going to buy the graphic novels. Unfortunately, the number that they started with was not a good place to start with. If they'd started at 100,000 and gone down from there, that would have been fine. But they started with like 26,000. Which is big for manga, but not for Twilight. Mm. From Shintaku, he wants to know, what are some short manga that everyone should read?
Short manga.
I was thinking about that. I saw that question. I was thinking about that because I'm thinking, what is our definition of short when, you know, we have 50 volumes in a lot of series?
I'll tell you what. I'll just put a rule on this. 10 volumes or less.
Oh. You're a dog. That's the rule I was going to impose.
it's my show, damn it.
To keep it short, Ponentmon/Fanfare, anything they publish, I recommend. And the longest series that they're going to put out is going to be
five volumes, I think, for Summon of the Gods.
But anything with Jiro, is it going to be five? I thought it was four, but anyway.
I think it's five.
Jiro Taniguchi, his artwork is just gorgeous, and I recommend any of his stuff, Walking Man or A Distant Neighborhood. But Ponentmon Fanfare is one of those publishers I grab anything they put out. The other publisher that I do that for is Vertical. And again, with the exception of Blackjack, all of their series are under 10 volumes. So Buddha or Apollo's Song, Chi will go over 10 volumes, but Pipachu is only going to go 3. And so they're another publisher that I just, if I see their name on the spine, I just buy it. Because, the chances of me not liking it are pretty slim. And then for Viz, I'll champion Pluto till they put me in the grave. Ghost in the Shell, it's only 2 volumes. Akira is only 3 volumes. And actually Paradise Kiss, which is one of the few Jose I've ever read, but it was excellent. So I definitely recommend that too.
I like Astral Project. Astral Project is only 4 volumes. That's up from CMX. It's by the author who wrote Old Boy. It's actually quite interesting suspense novel about a guy who ends up going astral traveling to find his sister who has been murdered. It refers to government conspiracies, John Coltrane, hallucinogenics. It's a really smart and interesting series that's only 4 volumes long. That's really easy to get into and get to like. I was actually working on this thing. Like, there's short attention span manga and long-term commitment manga. Real is very good. Real is only up to 5 volumes, I believe, by Takehiko Inoue, about basketball players who are handicapped. It's beautifully drawn, wonderfully, wonderful characterization. I'm trying to think, because a lot of them, do kind of go on and on. But it is interesting to try to find manga that's short. Some of these things, like you think, oh, well, it's short, but that's because there's only 2 volumes out now, and who knows how long it's going to go on.
Right, okay. Gia, anything pop into your head?
Yeah, I want to throw out one, although I feel kind of bad because I think it's out of print. But Rumiko Takahashi has these Rumic World and Rumic Theater short story anthologies. I think there were 4 or 5 of them total. I think one came out in Japan and never came out here. But it was all short stories. They were really, she's so famous for these incredibly long Rama 1/2 Inuyasha kind of series. But she actually does some really cool, really quirky sort of, they're always somewhat comedic, but sometimes they're horror, sometimes they're just straight comedy, sometimes there's mystery. Really fun short stories. I really, really enjoyed reading those, but I really don't think they're in print anymore, unfortunately.
No, they haven't been in print in a long time, but yeah. I agree with you. That's I wish she would do more of those kind of quirky slice of life stories, because I enjoyed them a lot too, and it's a good place, I think, if you're like Ramna or Inuyasha kind of scare you, that's a good place because the art's going to be the same, and really even the sense of, I think, characterization is pretty close to what you get in those series. And then I always tell people, as far as Ramna goes, the first 5 volumes are the best, and if you want to keep reading, you can, but the first 5 volumes are really good because it's a lot of social and gender satire in there, and then it kind of becomes like villain of the week, kind of weird karate.
It's the same arc over and over again, and over and over and over and over and over again.
Right.
Yeah, well, the anime is the same. If you watch the first season, congratulations, you've seen every single trick that show has. They'll shake the bag and they'll be in a different order in the next season. But yeah, Ranma. Actually, here's a question for you guys. Do any of you give a shit at all about Rinnei?
I've been reading it and enjoying it.
Really?
I have. I like that it's a little more toned down than Takahashi's other. My favorite Takahashi was actually Urusei Yatsura, which I think is also mostly out of print now.
Yeah. It's way out of print.
But I think that some of her style of humor has gone back to being a little bit more dry after the drama that was a lot of Inuyasha. And by drama, I mean soap opera.
Yeah.
Well, that's my only problem with Rinnei is it does feel like she's kind of rehashing a lot of old themes. And I need to get, I read the first, I guess, 5 or 6 chapters online. And I need to go back and look at I think volume 3 is out, isn't it? Or actually volume 4 may be out too by now. I do want to look at where it is now in the series to see if it's kind of gotten over some of the early hurdles it had. Cause I do have a soft spot for her. I did like Ramna and I did like, Urusei Yatsura and the Rumic Theater. So, and she was one of the first I read when I got into manga. So,
as with so many of us. Yeah, I just did a big, huge catch-up just last week, kind of on a whim. And, you know, I mean, it is sort of episodic, you know, it was sort of two or three chapter arcs for the most part. But I find them really fun. And, you know, I will say I like the female character in Rinne Sakura, Mamiya, better than I liked Kagome or Akane. I never liked Akane in Ranma One Half, true story. And Kagome was just too sweet for me. I like Sakura because she's sarcastic a lot.
But, you know, Kagome was much better in the manga than she was in the anime. And that always kind of frustrated me because I read the manga up through, I think, volume 25. And was watching the anime on Cartoon Network and was really shocked how much they toned down her character in the anime. They made her much weaker, much more kind of subservient. And I was really upset with the anime for doing that because I thought, here's you know, at least up through the first 25 volumes, here's a fairly strong and capable female lead who can kind of hold her own. And in the anime, she's always the helpless damsel. So I was, yeah, a little shocked by that.
The typical Rumiko Takahashi, helpless damsel who's a bitch to everyone who's trying to save her.
No, Kagome was not bitch. That was Akane was bitchy.
Kagome was plenty bitchy. I had to sit through a lot of that show. I was dating someone at the time who was really into Inuyasha, so I had to watch a shit ton of it. Kagome was a bitch like half the time. All of her female characters. I don't like any of Takahashi's characters. The only one that came close was like the characters in Risa Yatsura at least owned like who they were. Like Ataru was an asshole. He owned it.
He certainly did.
Like, kind of like how Scott Pilgrim owns his assholeness.
that whole series is him becoming not such an asshole.
I guess so.
All right.
Okay. From Alex Leavitt, your friend and mine, he says, do you like or recommend any manga that haven't been published in English?
Let's see. I've been liking, well, Saint Onisan is one. That's really a lot of fun. There's one called...
Well, say what that is so people know what that is.
Oh, Saint Onisan is basically a manga that probably will never be released in America because it's about Jesus and Buddha as 20-somethings living, taking a break from being Jesus and Buddha, hanging out in an apartment in Tokyo. So
that's nowhere near as controversial as it sounds.
Well, no, everybody's like, oh, no one will ever publish it. The religious controversy is too great. And I'm like, really?
It's super tame. I've read it.
It's really charming, but, you know, I also live in San Francisco. So
the concept alone, yeah.
No. And there's another manga that I've been dying to get licensed. Ultra Heaven is by Keiichi Koike. It's about a weird future where all hallucinogenic drugs are legal. But so it gives this artist an opportunity to draw these incredible drug trip sequences. They're amazing. They're really, really good. But I actually talked to someone at Dark Horse and says, dude, you have to license this. This is the most amazing manga. And he goes, we tried, believe me. But there's some kind of licensing hang up. But it is published in French. If you can read French, go and look it up. It is astounding. I've bought it in Japanese and I can't read it all in Japanese. But just the art alone is awesome. Oh, the other one, it's like Shigeru Mizuki manga. Gegege no Kitaro. I've been wanting to read that.
I would be interested in seeing that.
Yeah. It's too bad. The Drawn Quarterly is bringing out two Shigeru Mizuki titles next year, but it isn't Gegege no Kitaro. One is basically about Mizuki's memories of this old woman in his village who told him all the yokai stories. And that the Anglo-M. So I'm looking forward to that a lot.
Well, and the second one is about his World War II experiences, isn't it?
Yes, correct. I mean, a lot of people maybe don't understand this, but Shigeru Mizuki lost his arm in the war. So you can imagine that he's been drawing all of this incredible manga with one arm. Dude. Well,
and actually what's interesting is he was right-handed and he lost his right arm. Mm-hmm. So he had to learn he had to retrain himself to be left-handed, which now when I look at his manga, I'm like, oh my god,
yeah,
that's pretty insane. Neat.
It's called Onward to Our Glorious Death, so it's basically a very clear-eyed look at what it was like to be a Japanese soldier in the Pacific arena.
He's one of several of that kind of World War II generation who have come out and been very vocal against the imperial government from World War II. I mean, Barefoot Ginn is again very hypercritical of the Japanese government during World War II, and even Grave of the Fireflies, very hypercritical of the Japanese government. So it's interesting. I'm glad that we're getting these works here because it is an interesting perspective to get those people who are critical, because we generally don't think of Japanese soldiers as being that kind of vocal against the imperial government. Gege no Ketero is killing me because every academic and his brother keeps writing these articles about the manga, and I don't read Japanese, so unfortunately I can't sample it, but everything I read just makes me want to read it more because it sounds so wonderful. And in D.C. and then again in New York, they held an exhibit because he did a group of plays.
57 of Tokaido with Yokai.
Yes. And then part of that was there was a half-hour video. Mm. I don't remember if Kinokuniya in New York showed the video, but they did in D.C. when they had the exhibit, which was talking to him about Yokai and then interviewing various people and talking about how he had become a respected, kind of yokai authority among, cultural anthropologists, mm-hmm. because he had done all this reading, he knew all these like really obscure legends and urban legends, and it just sounds like it's unfortunately it's one of those manga that sounds very steeped in Japanese mm-hmm. Culture, which is why I really want to read it. And at the same time, I can understand why people are leery about bringing it over because they're scared that it's not really going to connect with an audience here.
Yeah, I think if you really talk about what I would love to see licensed, it's stuff that I just know will never make it here because it requires a certain love for the classics. And I don't think the manga reading, the vast majority of the manga reading buying public out there appreciates the classics, which is anything that was created before 1985.
I think that goes for all forms of media.
Yes,
yeah,
that's true.
It's nice. It almost seems like Europe. I was just looking into this new anime channel in Italy, and they've got a bunch of older shows that are running. The titles are totally failing me right now. But I remember thinking Europe seems a lot more willing to go to those older titles, I think, than the U.S. is.
Now, I have to tell you a story about Italy. Audia Palmer, who runs Tezuka in English.com and who is a Renaissance scholar, actually, teaches Renaissance thought as her day job, goes to Italy yearly as part of her kind of research. And we talk about the scanlation problem here in America. In Italy, these little overnight publishers pop up and they print 70s shoujo. Hmm. And they print them on, it's cheap stock. It's a one print run deal because they're not licensed, but they are translated into Italian. And she's like, if you see it, you buy it because these people will never come back again. Wow. And so it was really weird. I thought, wow, you know, we talk about scanlators, but they're not putting product on the market like that. And she's like, yeah, I mean, there's a name and address in the back of the book. She goes, but if you go there, it's an abandoned office. She goes, yeah, these guys, print, sell, and run. And that's the way they make their money. But she says you can pick up stuff that's even has been out of print for like 30 years in Japan. Mm-hmm. You'll be walking through the bookstore in Italy one day, and there'll be a complete set of it in Italian. And she's like, you just buy it. And she goes, so that's really, it's really interesting. Part of that is Italy had anime and manga from like the 70s, actually. So they actually grew up. There's a whole generation that grew up watching it and reading it. And they're really into their second generation of, people who've had it for their whole lifetime. Definitely. And same with France. France loves Tezuka, and they are on a tear right now publishing Tezuka books. It's killing me. Every time Helen McCarthy has an interview, she talks about some new French edition of Tezuka she just picked up for a series that we haven't even thought about licensing over here yet.
Well, France is pretty crazy about manga in general. They're pretty nuts about it.
But they also have a tradition of comics for adults, even in their native language. You know, they have much more longer tradition of appreciating comics as art.
Let's list all the artists that name Mobius as a huge influence.
Exactly. Okay. Indeed.
Yeah.
And also, Italy has Milo Manara, for example. You know, I mean, Europe in general has a very strong tradition of comics as not being just for kids anymore.
Mm-hmm. Bang, pow. Like, comics just, not just like, for kids. Okay, finally from, we got to wrap this up, ABCB Tom. What are the must-read manga titles that everyone's ignoring? He says, quick, and it has to be unanimous as well. Now, I don't know what he means by that, but so manga titles everyone's ignoring.
Go ahead. Mayashimon.
Mayashimon?
I can go with Mayashimon.
Yeah, Mayashimon, yes.
So that's unanimous. Definitely. Mayashimon. I actually haven't read it yet, but I've seen the show, and the show's good. So not the live action. The anime. Live action's terrible.
Really? I like the live action a lot.
Well, that's why you're not an anime reviewer.
there you go.
I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Okay, guys. Well, listen, that was a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on this evening and talking to us. That was great fun. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. All right,
well, thanks for having us. Heat Guy J.
God damn it. Okay, that's our show. I want to thank Deb and Ed for joining us this week. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, and we'll see you all next week.